Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. While many Pennsylvanians await a grand jury report on sexual misconduct and sexual abuse of children allegedly committed by Catholic priests and others associated with the church, that will is scheduled for next week or maybe the week after, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Harrisburg yesterday released a report that named 71 priests and others who have been accused of abuse and misconduct since 1947. Half of those names on the list are deceased, and most were never charged with a crime. In fact, we don't think any of them have ever been charged with a crime. On today's program, we discuss the report and its aftermath. Joining us on today's program is State Representative Mark Rossi of Berks County. Representative Rossi, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Also, Pennsylvania's victim advocate, Jennifer Storm. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Angela Little, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance. Angela, welcome back as well.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. That is the number to call. If you have a question or comment you'd like to leave on WITF's Facebook page, that's where you should go. Just go to WITF's Facebook page, and you can leave that question or comment on Twitter. We are on Smart Talk WITF. I want to start something that we heard yesterday.
Express my sadness that youth under the church's supervision were abused. Many of those victimized as children continue as survivors to suffer from the harm they experienced. In my own name, and in the name of the Diocesan Church of Harrisburg, I express profound sorrow and I apologize to the survivors of child sex abuse.
Representative Rossi, I'll start with you, and I'm going to ask all three of our guests today your reaction to what you heard yesterday from Bishop Gaynor and the diocese.
I do appreciate the bishop's comments and that he was taking the advice from his advisors, the recommendations that they put in front of him to be very transparent, to release the names, to waive the confidentiality agreements between victims. That's a huge step forward for the diocese, finally to be open and transparent. Unfortunately, what the bishop didn't say yesterday, though, was that he would support the recommendations that would come out of the pending grand jury report that would give victims the opportunity to heal and get justice. And that's the major disappointment, because he is the president of the Catholic Conference, the legislative arm of the Catholic Church, which, you know, has been lobbying very, very hard senators and members of the House to oppose legislation that would actually give victims their day in court. So very proud of the movement forward. Should have been done 30, 40 years ago, but at least we're at this point right now.
What you're talking about is extending the statute of limitations for criminal charges, and I'm sure that's going to be a big topic of conversation during our discussion today. Angela Little, how about you? Your reaction to what you heard yesterday?
Well, I guess I looked at it as a good, small first step. I'm not sure I see it as such a large step. I think that it fell a bit short, and I think it's one thing to apologize to those victims who were sexually abused, but I think the apology could have extended a bit further, because there was more committed in terms of harm to these victims by the cover-up of the church. And the church has yet to really accept, in my view, full accountability and responsibility.
Now, one thing that Bishop Gaynor did say yesterday, and this goes to what you were just saying, is that he was apologizing for people in his position. In other words, people in the church hierarchy in the diocese that may have overlooked or may have moved priests to other parishes or other dioceses. So he did kind of address that, but that wasn't enough for you.
I don't think victims need kinda right now.
Okay. Exactly.
I think what they need is, we were wrong. We were harmed. This is a little bit of vindication for what we've been saying for many, many years. And, you know, Scott, I've spent almost 30 years working in child abuse prevention. As a top leader of a nonprofit, I've tried to really be politically correct. And I woke up this morning and I'm tired of being politically correct. That's just the bottom line. This has been going on for decades. This has been in every diocese of this state. And this does not limit within Pennsylvania borders. OK, Okay, this is a large issue. And so it's time, you know, for us now. In my heart, I am just absolutely outraged. I am appalled. I think that anything short of the Vatican at this point being stripped of their gold opulence is not enough. That's how I feel in my heart. In my head, I believe that we have to focus on what do we do differently, because our responsibility now is to help those who've been harmed. But beyond that, to look out for the children who are yet to come before us, and to make sure that this never, ever happens again. And it has to come from public outcry. It has to come from those people who sit in the pews and who contribute to the church and who have been faithful to the church. There has to be a demand for accountability and a zero tolerance for the maltreatment of children.
Part of what Bishop Gaynor and the diocese talked about yesterday was implementing some rules to protect children in the future, and we'll talk about that as well. But first, I wanted to get Jennifer Storm's take on this.
No, I agree with everything that was said. I think, you know, what happened yesterday and hearing an apology of any kind and an acknowledgement of any kind, I think is important for survivors. But it does fall short when it's only coming out because exposure is around the corner. Right. So where were these apologies and where was this acknowledgement prior to the grand jury report, prior to it being known that all of these priests were going to be identified anyway? I feel like this was strategic on the part of the Catholic Church and the Harrisburg Diocese to get in front of the story, to try to put out their own spin on the story, because they know next week and or 2 weeks from now, whenever this report comes out, it's either going to be the 8th or the 14th, they're going to be exposed. And there are 900 pages of horrific violations of children. What you're going to read is going to be unlike anything we've seen in any grand jury report, and they know that. So I do think, again, I think it's important for survivors to hear acknowledgement, to hear, I didn't really hear accountability so much. And as I looked at the materials that they put out, I didn't really see that, you know, first and foremost, it should be, yes, we will make sure that no children will ever be harmed again. And then second, we will hold accountable. And I didn't see the word accountability on their website. So that was a little troubling for me. I would have liked a little bit stronger of a stance. And I agree with Representative Rossi. Without creating a path for accountability for survivors by eliminating our arbitrary statute of limitations, you continue to allow silence to win, and you continue to silence survivors, and that's unacceptable.
As I mentioned in the introduction, none of the 71 people yesterday, as far as we know, have faced criminal charges. And the statute of limitations is a big reason there.
Yes.
But something that was very unusual in what Bishop Gaynor did yesterday was that he listed everyone, this report lists everyone who has been accused of sexual misconduct or sexual abuse of children. And that's unusual in that most of the time, you and Jen, you know this well, that unless someone actually faces criminal charges, you do not hear their names publicly. Now, when half of them, more than half of them, are dead, it's a little bit different.
Yep.
But at the same time, this is unusual. Representative Rossi, what about that? I mean, coming out and talking about everyone who has been accused.
Again, you know, Bishop Gaynor, you know, a couple months ago was fighting hard to protect these guys' reputations. And all of a sudden, now he's throwing it out there. And I agree with Jennifer Storm and Angela that they're trying to get ahead of this now. They're trying to the save face by putting these names out and act like they're actually doing something to prevent child abuse. And again, this is only for their own self-benefit. If this report wasn't coming out right now, this list would have never been exposed.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the sad part.
And the names are coming out anyway. So I
really
don't
exactly
think
right.
The Catholic Church did anything huge yesterday by release. They just preemptively released them so they could try to get ahead of the story. These names were going to get released. They're in the report. So, I think that the Church has to be better about being transparent and honest. You know, they engaged a lot of survivors in non-disclosures over the years to keep survivors quiet. And then miraculously, when we had brave, amazing families challenging those non-disclosures, then all of a sudden they came out and said, oh, no, we don't hold you accountable to those anymore. But they never sent out a notification. So all the survivors, many of whom I talk with on a daily basis, who signed those non-disclosures, were never informed that, oh, that you're no longer held to that. You actually now can share your story and you can break your silence. So it's a continual manipulation.
by members of the church.
And I want to piggyback on that, too, from the opposite side, because what Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance does is train mandated reporters statewide, inclusive of priests and paid staff and volunteers within the Catholic Church at large in Pennsylvania, as well as many other institutions, organizations, and agencies. And what I would say about this, so full disclosure, we work with many of the dioceses, and there are many, many good people. We need to say that right up front. There are many, many good people who work and volunteer and are part of these faith communities, the parishes, the churches, the social service arm. That said, even after we had two major grand jury reports out of Philadelphia, after we had the Altoona Johnstown grand jury report, which was horrific to read those details, we still had dioceses that were very private and insular in terms of their child protection policies. So one of the things, when we have all of this anger and this angst, and what do you do with it? One of the things we've got to do, as I said, is focus on how can we make this different moving forward. So one of the things is, how are we educating folks in seminary? This is a profession that puts them in place and in close proximity with folks at some of the most fragile and intimate, vulnerable times in life. And then, how are we really establishing the policies? Some of the dioceses, of course, they have people who are experts on canon law. That does not make them an expert on the Child Protective Services law. And they are still a bit slow to reach out from themselves and really have any input from folks who really do understand policies and training programs that address these things.
I'm curious, though, Angela, something you just said about a different kind of training in seminary. What do you mean by that? Because the reason I asked that question is because if someone is attracted to a child in a sexual way, training in seminary doesn't sound like it would stop that.
It doesn't. But I think what has to happen is, again, what we've said at PFSA, and I think anyone who works in child welfare would agree with this, you really have to have a three-pronged approach to good, solid child protection within a church or any other group that serves children. You have to have really strong background clearances and child abuse clearances and criminal history clearances. And then you have to have really strong child protection policies, which at all costs, no matter what, no matter the environment, prohibits one adult with one child. You need to have what's called a two-deep leadership. And then you need to have ongoing training on how do you recognize child abuse, how do you report it immediately according to the law. And wrapped in all of that has to be a zero tolerance. So that's really the piece that I'm not sure. I think there has to be some discussion about that. When folks are in seminary for working in a faith community, how is that zero tolerance really communicated? You know that if you're a teacher, you know the risks. If you get involved in a sexual relationship, you're likely going to lose your license in Pennsylvania. Of course, the church has its own way of handling things. We have to be really strong right from the very start of this, what we mean by zero tolerance.
We're going to talk more. There's a whole lot more to talk about. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your phone home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our discussion today centers around the report that was released yesterday by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Harrisburg that talked about 71 clergy, about 37 priests and others involved in the church who have been accused over the years, and accused is a big word, accused over the years of sexual misconduct and sexual abuse of children. If you have a question or comment you'd like to weigh in on this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we take a call from Barbara, I just wanted to follow up on something you said before the break, Angela. You said that one of the things you would recommend or that should be done in the future is that there wouldn't be one-on-one. Okay, I just right off the top of my head, I thought about confession. I mean, you don't want to. There are some unique circumstances where clergy are, you know, providing therapy, providing comfort to someone, but you know, in this case, in the Catholic Church in particular, confession, that's a one-on-one. Mm-hmm. If you're going to confess, you don't want someone else to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I understand there's some unique challenges in this environment. And what I'm saying is that if we look at past history and we look at the number of victims and we look at the number of dioceses in Pennsylvania, and we know, just like with all child abuse reporting, I have no doubt this is underreporting.
And also, Scott, too, like, I wanted to just piggyback on what Angela said earlier about, you know, what we could do to curb this within the Catholic Church. And, you know, sexual abuse will happen across all institutions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think the real problem here, though, has been the bishops. The bishops have known about this, and instead of reporting it to the police, they protect the institution, they protect the priests, move them around, and then the victims are left to suffer. The bishops are the ones that are responsible for this mess. I mean, we're always going to have sex abuse in our institutions. I mean, it's just going to happen. There's bad people out there. But unless these bishops do their job, I mean, back in 2002, the Dallas Charter said, report child sex abuse to the police. And some bishops, still after that, even Gaynor, when he was the Bishop of Lexington, Kentucky, did not report child sex abuse to the police down there right away when he had cases in front of him. This is an absolute disgrace across our country, what these bishops have done. Just think of that. We have about 600 pedophile priests in Pennsylvania. What does that mean? How many pedophile priests does that mean that we have across our country, like 10, 12,000? That number is absolutely ridiculously high, and it's the bishops that need to be held accountable here. And exactly, there was no accountability yesterday. And until they accept responsibility, we're not moving forward.
Let me just play a clip from Bishop Gaynor addressing that very issue.
It was also clear that the leadership of the church did not, in every case, take adequate measures while handling matters related to offending clerics.
So, in Representative Rossi, that's not being accountable?
Absolutely not. For them to be accountable, when they get a child abuse claim in front of them, they needed to call the police. They never did that. They always protected the institution. He can say that now because of what's happening. The grand jury is coming out, and believe me, I do appreciate that he's removing the names of the bishops off of all buildings, mm-hmm. including Cardinal Keeler's mm-hmm. name, who no doubt covered up child sex abuse in the Harrisburg Diocese. This, you know, is a movement forward, but again, until they accept responsibility for their actions, their words are meaningless. Action speaks.
Angela, I wanted you to be able to finish your thought, what you were saying. Okay, we can get back to that if you want.
Well, let's piggyback a little bit on what Representative Rossi said. You know, I met, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, with Bishop Persico in Erie County. So I think there's a difference. You know, people use the words honesty and transparency, sometimes with great ease. And I don't necessarily believe that it's such honesty and transparency when you're pushed into a corner and you don't really have much of a choice, because either you come out with it or it's going to be all over the media in mm-hmm. 7 or 10 days. I have to say, you know, could be wrong, because we know that there are some wolves in sheep's clothing, obviously. But in meeting with Bishop Persico, I went there specifically. I wanted to thank the man, because he was the only bishop mm-hmm. in this state. Not only did he voluntarily and was the first to release the names who he considered and they termed credibly accused, but he also listed the names of laypersons, which is very, very important. This is not just people who are employed as their profession within the church. This is people who gravitate towards where children are. And that's what we need to be mindful of. Not only did he do that, he was the only bishop who was willing to sit in front of the grand jury and be questioned. Mm-hmm. He, in essence, became the embodiment of the church for victims to be able to really address. And beyond that, had incredible humility around the policies he and the vicar of their child protection office really wanting to make sure that they strengthen things, and seemed very genuine about that. And there wasn't media, there wasn't any splash with it. It was a very private conversation. So I think that's honesty and transparency. I don't necessarily think that when you're pushed into a corner.
Let's take some phone calls. Barbara is in Quarryville. Barbara, you're on the air.
This infuriates me. This just makes me so mad, because priests take a vow of celibacy. That doesn't mean that you can do this to anybody. I mean, this is so infuriating. I'm a nun, and my vows are important to me, and theirs should be important to them.
You said,
and don't tell me boys will be boys, you guys, because I'm not going to.
I always said that if nuns were running the church, that this problem would have never happened. And I honestly believe that. It's these men that are out of control that allowed this to happen.
Absolutely.
So, sister, though, is it Sister Barbara?
Well, you may, yeah.
Okay. I'm curious, were you ever aware of this going on in any of the parishes you were involved with?
I was not. I've been in a very quiet position. I'm one of these nuns that is, I'm Anglican, not Roman.
Oh, okay.
And in the two communities in which I was a part, there was nothing. And I was looking hard because I'm also a rape victim.
You're also a rape victim?
Yes.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for calling in and adding to our conversation today. Thank you very much for being with us. Jennifer, you kind of disagreed when she said, you were saying that you're not real sure about this was just men.
Well, I want us to be really careful that we're not pigeonholing this discussion, right? We know that women can also sexually offend. So we also know that priests were not only abusing young boys, they were abusing young women, right? So I want to make sure that we're being really clear that we're not gendering this issue so much that we're creating a false narrative or a false sense of security. We know that there are female teachers who have offended and raped their students. So it's not like that doesn't happen. Certainly, I think, and I think that the nun made a good point and when talking about seminary and that celibacy. First of all, raping children is not being celibate, okay? That's not the definition of that. I do think the very nature of celibacy and denying someone the ability to have love and affection and intimacy in their lives could certainly be a problem. I'm not saying that leads to abuse, because it doesn't. But certainly there are a lot of things that need to happen in seminary. We were talking earlier, you know, that if you want to be a state trooper in the state of Pennsylvania, you have to take a psychological assessment. Is there a psychological assessment that occurs in seminary? If not, should there be? Should there be not some type of an assessment that can predict this type of predilection? Like, we need to get to the background checks are not going to get there, because these individuals are skilled. Predators know how to avoid accountability. They hide in the silence of their survivors. And so oftentimes there's not going to be a child line. There's not going to be a criminal conviction. Rarely is there going to be a criminal conviction. So I think we need to be doing more to identify these individuals who we're allowing to have unfettered access to children.
Let's take a call from Joe in Camp Hill. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. It was interesting to hear from Sister Barbara. I, too, am Anglican Episcopalian. The leadership in our church years ago, I think the insurance provider and the leadership of the National Episcopal Church collaborated to come up with a safeguarding God's children. We have to have the criminal background checks and the child abuse checks if we work with children in any way, or if we have a key to the church, which allows us access to the church when there is no one else there. Because what might we walk in on, or what might we proliferate? So we're pretty carefully screened. Now, I know the politics of the Episcopal Church and of the Roman Catholic Church are quite different, but I would point this out. I'm not going to blame the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church. In the Episcopal Church, the laity is responsible for the safeguarding of children. It's reported to the police, and it is also reported to the rector of the parish, but the laity are the people that are charged with taking care of our children, and I would encourage the Roman Catholic Church to consider that very strongly. Thank you.
Joe, thank you very much for your
call. You know, Scott, I'd like to chime in on that. I was with one of your media partner friends last night over at CBS 21 doing the evening news. And off the record, a young man said to me, you know, I have a five-year-old, and my wife and I are really concerned. What do you think we should look at with our child around signs and symptoms? And I thought, whoa, we need to flip this conversation. And it needs to be not waiting to look for signs and symptoms with your child, but what do you as a parent need to do? So this speaks a little bit to what the caller just said. We need to have the people, the parishioners, they need to get in the game, and they need to be far more active than they are and vigilant around their children. We have these issues all over the place in Pennsylvania. We have unlicensed, unregulated daycare centers that are operating, and we have parents who are not, sometimes, unfortunately, because of very poor options, but we have parents who are not knowledgeable enough about what they need to check on, what they need to ask, and what they need to demand. So some of these things, are they hard issues to grapple within the church? Of course they are. The seal of confession, I understand. That's challenging. There's all kinds of things that could happen within a parish or a church that are now difficult with a different lens to look at how do we adapt. But here's the truth of it. We have to adapt. We have to change. We have to do things differently. And if that means we reconfigure some of the activities within the church, if that means that parents still want their kids to be involved in church or parish activities, maybe that means they participate too. Maybe that means they ask and demand really hard questions around how that's structured and the level of supervision.
But Angela, I don't know if you're Catholic or not.
I am not.
Oh, you're not. Okay.
I did, however, work for a church for years, and I spent a few years in seminary.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have noticed, I'm not Catholic either, but I was married Catholic. My wife is Catholic, family's Catholic, is the deference toward the church. Mm-hmm. That what you just described with the laity, with the parishioners, you know, people in the clergy, priests especially, are held in such high esteem. They never could imagine some
exactly
of these things
correct.
Happening.
But look at it with other professions too. We're taught not to question doctors. Doctors know more than we do. We go to them because we have a need. We go to pastors and priests and rabbis because we have a need for some type of faith and sometimes the comfort that comes from that. And that is what actually should outrage us the most.
Yes, but at the same time, and I'm not disagreeing.
We don't question.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but what I'm saying is you're absolutely right using doctor as a good example. But when you're the person you're talking about could
is representing God.
Is representing God and could have, determine your fate for all eternity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little bit different than a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the only thing today I can say about that is maybe folks who look at it like that ought really to be questioning how much authority and credence they put in those individuals.
Yeah. Representative Rossi, you have made it very well known, and one of the reasons you are so passionate about this issue is that you are a survivor, that when you were 13, that there was a priest in your parish that, you were sexually abused. So a lot of the things we're talking about, I'm curious, like, for example, did you tell anyone afterwards? Did people believe you? Did people, the priest who was the perpetrator, this priest, did he have this great reputation that you probably thought that no one would believe me? Just how did that work out?
He was a new priest, Father Edward Graff, that came to our parish, Holy Garden Angels, and he was the cool priest. Everybody was talking about how this priest was cool to hang out with, and as like a seventh grader, I was excited. I was like, I can't wait to meet this priest. And then it was a Friday morning mass when I was in eighth grade, when now I can look back and I know that he was drunk, but in the middle of mass, he just stopped saying mass and started walking down the aisle and started screaming at somebody. Well, that person he was screaming at was me. And I was sitting there with my class and I had no idea what was going on. And I know that's the day that he picked me. That's the day he backed me in the corner where I would have done anything he wanted. And he stood there screaming at me, telling me to be quiet and behave and listen. And I was just shocked. And after the Mass was over, my teacher said, you better go up and talk to Father Graf. And I went up to the front of the altar, and he put his arm around me and said, everything's going to be all right. We're going to have to spend some time together and do some work around the parish. And that's how my whole process and the grooming process began. And, you know, he abused me in 1983 and 1984. And at that time, my statute of limitations, I think I only had 2 years civilly and 5 years criminally. But in 1988, they removed him from my parish, and they sent him to the Servants of the Park Elites in Jimenez Springs, New Mexico, which was established by the Roman Catholic Church in 1947 to treat sexually abusive priests. And after they rehabbed him for sexual abuse, they put him into the Amarillo Diocese, where he abused about another 20 children. We put his numbers at close to 200. So think about that. If we're identifying, like, say, maybe close to 600 priests, and let's say each of them have about 20 victims, that's about 12,000 children that was abused. If each of them have 200 victims, we're talking about 120,000 child victims of sexual abuse. The numbers are outrageous. Mm-hmm.
And here's what we think about that with the church, too. Think about what the church is all about. It's about grace and forgiveness. They have to really think about that because, yep, honestly, there shouldn't be a second time around on that. There shouldn't be, yeah, grace and forgiveness where you get another chance. This has to be the one issue. Sexual abuse, maltreatment of people in general, has to be, you do it once, you're done.
Let's take a phone call from Melanie in Newburgh. Melanie, you're on the air.
Hi there. I actually have a question about statute of limitations. Earlier in the program, one of your guests made a comment about it being an arbitrary number. In my family, a family member was abused by another family member. And because of that, there was a lot of counseling. And one of the things that the counselors talked about was that, on average, it can take about 7 years for a victim of traumatic sexual assault to be able to articulate what they went through. And it bothers me so deeply that we put these limitations where if it takes them 7 years to be okay talking about it, but if they only have 2 or 3 years to press charges, why?
That
doesn't make sense to me in any way.
Melanie, thank you very much for your call. Representative Rossi, this is an issue that, again, you have been passionate about. What is the statute of limitations now, and what would you like to see?
The current statute of limitations is you have till age 30 civilly and age 50 criminally. What we do know is the average age of a person that's coming forward that was abused as a child, we believe, is age 52. Our statutes don't even cover that. Mm-hmm. But again, where most of these crimes happen, that's going to come out in this grand jury report, the statutes were very arbitrary. I mean, mm-hmm, the 2 years civilly, 5 years criminally. I had a girl email me this morning who was abused by Dr. Bardo out in Johnstown. Her statute of limitations run out. Mm-hmm. And she has no pathway to justice because of what the Catholic Conference and what Bishop Gaynor is doing within the Catholic Conference, the legislative arm, to block measures not only for Catholic victims, but all victims of sexual abuse. And that's why we need Bishop Gaynor to say, you know what, we're going to get behind the statute of limitations. All victims, not just clergy victims, all victims deserve justice.
Jennifer, you are a rape survivor, mm-hmm, not by a Catholic priest. But what Melanie was saying about 7 years to reconcile what had happened to, yep, you, what about in your case? I mean, did it take some time for you to understand what had happened?
Oh, my gosh.
Maybe,
yeah,
tell people?
So my case was obviously a bit unique. I was young, and my parents immediately knew because I had been away from home for so long, and kidnapping charges were never filed, but I mean, I wasn't returned to my home until 2 o'clock, so the police were already there and involved. So I was immediately taken to the hospital and had a rape exam. So I identified my perpetrator, and there was a trial. However, my parents then negotiated a plea that was way, 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 way less than what he should have had, and I didn't know that for... Gosh, I found that out 15 years ago, right? So I had been kind of misled by my family for so long. I think that we need to empower survivors to be able to come to terms with what happened to them in a time frame that is psychologically and emotionally healing and appropriate for them, and then we need to have every avenue of justice for them. You know, I'm a big supporter of abolishing the statute of limitations. Yes. I don't understand why we need them. They make no sense. We don't have them in murder cases. We now have means by which to preserve rape kits, to have evidence preserved for the time when that victim is ready to come forward. We are now finally starting to uncover all of this horrific, horrendous abuse that has occurred years and years ago when our statute of limitations were incredibly arbitrary. How we don't open up a window of justice for those individuals to come forward and seek justice. And so many people think this is, oh, it's not about money. It's about accountability. It's about naming their abuser. And it's about the freedom to tell their story and be believed. That's what it is for so many of these survivors. It's not about some big payday. And I agree with Representative Rossi. The church, unfortunately, has been the biggest barrier in Pennsylvania. They have put millions of dollars towards stopping the statute of limitation bills from moving forward. And so they're not just barring justice for their own victims that they're trying to protect in their own institution, but every single victim of sexual abuse in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. It's unjust.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing the report issued yesterday by the Harrisburg Catholic Diocese that went all the way back to 1947, accusations of sexual abuse, sexual misconduct against priests and others involved in the church. Our guest today, State Representative Mark Rossi of Berks County, Pennsylvania's victim advocate Jennifer Storm, Angela Little, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Steve in Middletown. Steve, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my comment.
Yes, you're welcome.
I'm just curious whether or not the bishops might have been pedophiles themselves, and that's why they did not come out against these other priests. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. There were no bishops on that list yesterday. I don't know whether there were bishops in other dioceses across the country that have been accused. Are you aware of any out there?
I believe there have been bishops that have been abusing children. I believe there's bishops that have been having romantic relationships with women or same-sex relationships. And that all leads to the cover-up. If, you know your bishop is having an affair with a woman and you're abusing children, nobody's telling on each other. But the secret continues.
But Representative Rossi, when you say that, hold on just a second, Angela, when you say that, you believe that, what evidence do you have to back that up?
Well, we always used to hear out of Philadelphia that Bevilacqua had a girlfriend down there, that, you know, that was going on. And there was always talked about that, well, if he has a girlfriend and he has all these priests in the Philadelphia Archdiocese who are abusing children, who's going to tell on each other? Nobody is.
And Bevilacqua, I believe it's Anthony, right?
Yeah. That's correct.
Went on to become a cardinal
right.
in Philadelphia. Angela, what were you going to say? I didn't interrupt you.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, this is spreading not just in Pennsylvania and through the United States, but it's, you know, India, Asia, Argentina, Chile.
Australia.
And exactly, Australia. And we've heard more recently in the news about Pope Francis with a cardinal, where he took very aggressive action, unprecedented. I think it's highly likely what Representative Rossi's saying, but I also think the issue that we have to remember is these people in top leadership positions mm-hmm. are all about protecting the institution. Look at Penn State. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, the sentencing came out for the folks involved at Penn State, the two coaches, Graham Spanier, my position on that was, if you're the leader, you are held to a higher level of accountability and responsibility.
And he was the one that never saw the inside of a prison cell.
Exactly.
So how does that look?
And also you have Senator Jay Corman that represents that area, who should be a leader on statute of limitations reform to give past victims their opportunity at their day in court. And he's been silent on this matter. We need the majority leader of the Senate to start stepping up and start speaking out for victims and stop protecting pedophiles.
We have an email from Mary in Harrisburg who says, I was raised in a Catholic church, went to Catholic school my entire life. When I watched Spotlight, the movie, it really sunk in how terrible a scandal this was. And the line that hit me was, if it takes a community to raise a child, it takes a community to rape a child. Mm-hmm. I now go to a different church and I'm just amazed at the people, my family and friends, that still support the Catholic Church. It's crazy that they don't see the harm in what they are doing to support the church. I wish we'd push people more to stop supporting the Catholic Church. Now, I mean, I'm not here to advocate that, and I don't know whether you are or not. I mean, there are a lot of people who, millions of people over the years, who have had positive experiences, lived their lives through the Catholic Church. But we have had a lot of people who have left the church or have questioned the Catholic Church as a result of this. So, I mean, it is... Go ahead, Jennifer, what were you going to say?
So I don't think this is about, you know, taking down the Catholic Church, right? There are some wonderful, amazing things that members of the Catholic Church do day in and day out to help feed the homeless, to help provide comfort and care for so many individuals. So I don't think it's about dismantling the church. I do think that she makes a really strong point in that, and this I've heard from so many survivors, that it wasn't just the priests that were abusing them. Lots of folks in the church knew. The nuns knew. The staff knew. Some of the parishioners knew. But it was this cycle of power and control. So what those parishioners now can do, what those faithful Catholics can do now, is stand up, is speak out, is support the survivors, support their churches by talking about these issues, by bringing programs in to educate the children, educate the children's clergy, and continue the dialogue.
And that goes to what we've said, Scott, in many other programs that you know, you and I've had discussions on related to child abuse. It takes the entire community to protect kids. That's just the reality of it. We each have a responsibility to play. And so those folks who participate on whatever level within the parishes, the churches, the institutions, they need to ask hard questions and they need to speak out when they suspect something and when they believe the church is not being assertive or aggressive enough in dealing with it.
Let's take a call from Helen in York. Helen, you're on the air.
Good morning. I just have another comment. I know the people speaking are not all members of the Catholic Church, but why is not somebody lobbying for married priests? I know widowers can become a priest after their wife dies, so wouldn't that address the whole issue? The history of the church, it's only been a couple hundred years that celibacy has been an issue. So I just throw that out there. Might be nice if the Pope heard from enough people about married priests.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And I'm just going to weigh in here before we say that, in that saying that this has been suggested since we heard of the first clergy being involved with children. Maybe, you know, what Representative Rossi had suggested with a priest having an affair as an adult. That's a little bit different. But when you're attracted to children sexually, being married probably is not going to stop that.
Ask Dottie Sandusky.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there are so many.
Well, no, they're not a good example.
Not a good example, but he was married, right?
Right.
So
right,
marriage
right.
is not a preventative mechanism for child rape, right? There's something different that's happening in that individual. Now, I will say this: I do think that celibacy, for me, it doesn't feel natural, right? There's a denial there that feels not appropriate. That that secrecy, that requirement to seek love and affection in secrecy, I think could create some kind of psychological challenges, right? I think there's going to probably not a lot more research that needs to be done there. But I think when you have to do anything in secret, there's a problem, right? In general.
But what about her point of if they didn't have to take the vow of celibacy, that maybe there would not be the, okay, no, a kid's side, that's a different story, mm-hmm. but that maybe there wouldn't be these acts of sexual misconduct?
You mean in terms of affairs?
Yeah.
You know, again, it goes back to requiring someone to, A, say, I'm not going to ever have love in my life. That's in an intimate way, right? You can have love, obviously, without intimacy or without sexual intimacy, right? But I do think if you're telling somebody that this is forbidden, then it leads people to want it more, and then they're going to have to do that in secrecy because their entire lives are, you know, reliant upon them not doing that one thing. So, of course, it's going to lead to affairs.
Let's go to, let's see, we have Lanny in Mannheim. Lanny, you're on the air.
Hey, this is a great conversation. I really appreciate the topic. I mean, it brings home to me because my brother, in the late 60s, was molested by a Catholic priest, and his life was never the same since. But I think we also need a holistic discussion. We have a sex-drenched culture. We have, and it just didn't start in 1988. It started with Alfred Kinsey with human sexuality in the male. And that bizarre research and all of the things that he helped foundationally put in America, plus with the media and everything else, I think that, you know, the Catholic Church is at the tip of the iceberg. It is everywhere.
Yes.
And you even have activists like George Soros and everybody who doesn't want statute of limitations. They actually want to bring victims and the perpetrators together, like the crazy this is going on in Vermont.
I don't know about what you're saying. I don't know if that has credibility or not. But Representative Rossi, I heard you say yes there.
Yeah, well, you know, it does happen across, you know, all sectors of this child abuse. And you know, the main thing that we just need to do is when you find out that a child is being abused, you report it to the police,
mm-hmm.
bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, you don't go to the diocese, you don't go to your public school, you go to the police and you make the report. That's the best thing that you could do to protect your child moving forward from being hurt.
Unless you're a mandated reporter, child representative, and then
right.
you have to call Childline,
yes.
which is 1-800-932-0313.
Go ahead,
that's
just one thing I want to address. In some of the materials that the Diocese of Harrisburg put out yesterday, there's some real inconsistencies about reporting. And so if there's one thing that I would like for them to go back and do is to revise their materials and make it abundantly clear that Childline must be called at every single turn.
Well, what do you mean inconsistencies?
There's some inconsistencies where they talk about, well, maybe you call law enforcement, maybe you report it to your supervisor, and then they start talking about privilege. The privileged communications that you have with your priest. And mandated reporting is mandated reporting. If somebody reports child sexual abuse or child abuse, you must call Childline, period.
And this goes back to what I said to
call the diocese if
yes.
you report child
yeah.
sex
yeah,
abuse,
a,
which
yeah.
blew
and
my mind. I'm like, you'd never call the diocese
no.
to
and this
report
is,
child sex abuse.
This goes back to what I said very beginning of the program. I would call upon each and every diocese. Doesn't have to be Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance, though we sure would like to have 100% of the diocese working with us, but to have folks who are experts in the child welfare system and in Pennsylvania's Child Protective Services law review their policies and procedures, because I have found in most dioceses, some of them less than others, there are inaccuracies in terms of child abuse definition with mm-hmm. Pennsylvania law, the process for reporting, and some very vulnerable and weak spots within their policies.
Okay, by the way, part of this yesterday from the report is that the diocese, and they did establish a specific website for
yes.
reporting and a lot of other information, but they came out with some ways to protect kids. Reporting every allegation. Now, this said someone, it was reported as to the district attorney. I believe that was to supposed to be to police. Screen all employees and volunteers with multiple background certifications. Training employees to recognize and report abuse. Teaching students how to stay safe. So, your thoughts on those recommendations?
I don't think those are bad recommendations. You know, I think they need to be consistent, and I agree with Angela that there's some significant training that is needed within the diocese so that all the staff understand and appreciate the laws that govern reporting, that govern the definitions, and that govern their legal responsibility. They talk about a moral responsibility. We need to talk about the legal responsibilities that they have.
We only have a few minutes left, actually only about a minute left. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Representative Rossi, after what you heard yesterday, what are your thoughts on what the public should take away?
Well, you know, you heard that woman say about the lady getting involved. The people of this Commonwealth now have to call their legislator, their representative or their senator, and demand action. They have to demand that we eliminate the civil and criminal statute of limitations and that we implement a 2-year retroactive window to give all past victims, all past, not just Catholic clergy victims, a path to justice.
Yes.
And, you know, that's our responsibility as the public calling public officials like myself, demanding action. We can't let this go. The opportunity is right in front of us to do something great in this Commonwealth for our victims.
State Representative Mark Rossi of Berks County, Pennsylvania's victim advocate Jennifer Storm, Angela Little, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance, thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, well, we're going to talk about children again, but a much more positive way. A WITF's Ready, Set, Go kindergarten event is this Saturday. We're going to talk about early childhood education. That is part of tomorrow's program.